From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm producer Megan Mack.
And I'm host Evan Dawson.
Let's get right to it. On Tuesday, we welcomed Peter Reed. He's a Rochester native whose daughter Mary was killed in the 2007 Virginia Tech mass shooting.
Yeah, Mary Reed was 19 years old, one of 32 people killed that day. As you can imagine, her father Peter has dedicated much of his life to working to reduce gun violence. Now, he joined us by phone. You're going to hear him talking about why he thinks there's still hope for new legislation despite the influence of the NRA. And then I want you to listen to the phone call we took. I admit it kind of shook me up because the caller's tone was rather aggressive, but you're going to find that Peter handled that phone call better than I did.
Well, I draw a distinction in my own mind between responsible gun owners, and there are many in this country, even rank-and-file NRA members, and I draw a distinction between them and the top NRA leadership and their lobbyists who advocate extreme policy and legislative positions at the state and federal levels. But most, when you talk to them, you survey them, you find gun owners, you find NRA members, you find Republicans, Democrats, Independents, broadly supportive provisions like universal background checks. There is no overwhelming opposition to that among the public. There is an overwhelming opposition to any measures, I can't say any, but many measures at a state and federal level that comes from the NRA leadership and from other groups that have the means and the lobbying wherewithal to oppose those things.
I do want to grab a phone call. Someone's been waiting. This is Sean in Waterloo who has a question about what happens if some of these proposals become law. Go ahead, Sean.
I keep hearing from all of your side, all right? I hear, oh, we don't want to take guns. We're not for confiscation. You know, you're not for confiscation now. And I'm sorry, my side and a lot of people like me don't believe you in the first place when you say that you're not for confiscation. That's just a plain fact.
Hey, Sean, let me ask you a question then.
Not calling you a liar, because I won't, then fine. I will reflect on history. You guys don't want confiscation right now because you don't have that power. You guys can't get it across now. We're not going to let you.
All right, Sean. Sean, stop talking for a second. Let me ask you a question, because now you're getting rude, and I've got a guest on the program who is taking the time to join us. And I'm not going to let somebody call the program be rude. I would like to ask you a question, Sean. Let me ask you a question. Because I'm trying to appreciate all perspectives and concerns here. Your perspective seems to be that right now the proposal is not confiscation. But if we enact some of the measures that Peter Reed is talking about, that people like New Yorkers Against Gun Violence have talked about, that if we enact these things, then those folks will then say, well, now that we've got that, now let's move toward confiscation. And you're saying logically... Hold on.
Not just that.
Okay, hold on.
It'll be slow bites. It won't be straight to...
Okay.
Oh, well...
Okay, I understand. Your concern is that's where we're going eventually. That's what your concern is. But, unfortunately, if that's your position, it doesn't allow for any meaningful logical legislation, right? Because any even small logical step, in your point of view, would be a step toward the ultimate, which would be confiscation, right? Is there any legislation that you think should be allowable? Should we regulate guns at all?
I would have a more thorough enforcement of the current laws. We don't enforce the current laws thoroughly as we see. The media is basically on your side.
I'm on the side of evidence.
It's not on the gun rights side.
All right, sure. No.
So everything ends up high profile. I mean, guns as opposed to cars. You have people talking about how many people died from guns in the past week. Well, how many died from cars?
You think we're not talking about cars? You think we don't regulate cars?
No, we're not. Exactly.
That's interesting.
We're talking about guns.
All right, listen, I don't want to get snarky. I'm finding myself drifting to a territory I don't like as a host. So I'm going to cut the call off. Of course we regulate cars. I mean, that's ludicrous. And my position is one of evidence. That's it. I want a safe country. I don't want rights taken away that don't have a basis. But Peter Reed's my guest. He is the father of someone lost at Virginia Tech. And Sean, I'd let you go a little bit longer, but I think the tone was a little unfair here, especially with the guest that we have on. Peter, go ahead. Why don't you respond to some of what you heard?
Well, the caller has, you know, every right to voice his opinion,
sure,
to voice his concerns. I I would let them go on longer because people need to hear what the arguments, as you say, what the evidence is for not undertaking some of these common sense restrictions. You know, I have yet to see the evidence beyond the assertions of a widespread conspiracy that confiscation is the end goal here. You can't show it to me, or at least nobody has showed me any convincing evidence that such a conspiracy exists. But on the other hand, as we've been discussing, I can show you evidence all day long that we're, you know, losing 30,000 people a year to gun violence deaths. And the idea that we can't do anything about it because there's might be a conspiracy lurking out there over the horizon somewhere doesn't make any sense to me.
Peter Reed will visit the Rochester Public Library for a free public presentation this coming Tuesday at noon. Now let's turn to a local controversy, the closing of a grocery store.
And not just any grocery store. This is Constantino's Market. It opened less than a year ago. And here's where it gets controversial. Senator Chuck Schumer secured $750,000 in funding to help open the store last April. That's because it was technically located in a food desert on Upper Mount Hope. But it flopped. People in poverty either couldn't get to the store or couldn't afford the food being offered.
So we talked to Foodlink's Mitch Gruber, who says that we have to change the way we think about food deserts and helping people in poverty.
Food deserts, it's truly a discussion about poverty. I mean, that's what we said in the op-ed. It is a discussion about poverty, not a discussion about where a supermarket is.
Yeah.
It is about where the large concentrations of poverty are. And just because the Upper Mount Hope neighborhood doesn't have a supermarket doesn't make it a food desert. Their poverty rates are under 20%. The vast majority of the city of Rochester has poverty rates over 40%. Those where Ibero serves in the Northeast in the Crescent, that's the food desert. And we should be thinking about allocating federal dollars to those neighborhoods. But if we're going to do it, Evan, the contention that I would make is that it's not just throwing a private business at it. It's thinking more strategically about how we can actually solve this problem, because grocery is a notoriously low margin business. It requires quite a bit of volume, and it requires usually more than one location to be able to make a good business out of it. And Constantino's simply couldn't make that happen with one store operating in Rochester.
And that shouldn't have been a surprise, right?
I don't think so.
10 months ago, if I would have asked you, hey, what's the future of Constantino's? They're opening. A lot of fanfare. Were you scratching your head a little?
Good way of putting it. I try to remain as optimistic as I can about things. And I appreciate what Senator Schumer did. I appreciate Mayor Warren's support of projects like this, because the reality is food is a huge economic driver. And if we can have supermarkets work in neighborhoods that don't have them, great, that's wonderful. But, you know, I would point to programs and projects that Foodlink operates that are really intentionally about trying to eliminate food deserts. And I'm not talking about them in the way that just supporting food pantries and soup kitchens, although that is a critical part of what we do. I'm talking about market-based approaches where we actually have people set their watch to our presence, and we're buying and selling produce, but we're doing it with a mission-based approach, not a profit-based approach. And that is how we're going to have long-term solutions. That's not to say money isn't involved. Money is a big part of it. We can't go out and ask for grants for these programs every year and expect to call them sustainable. We have to be able to make enough sales to actually drive sustainability. But the mission-based, the mission-focused is critical. When it's just profit-based, the reality is that the decision Wegmans made in 2003 was a decision Constantino's had to make in 2016. And there wasn't going to be a difference there.
From one local controversy to another.
Yeah, Wednesday we welcomed Bob Duffy, the former lieutenant governor, former Rochester mayor, and CEO of the Greater Rochester Chamber of Commerce. He's also the head of the Photonics Council, and people are starting to get a little nervous. Now, this is going to sound very inside baseball, but stay with me. Assembly Majority Leader Joe Morelli has been in a dispute for months now with the president of SUNY Albany Polytech. That's Elaine Calieros. He's a big deal in this whole photonics thing. Calieros and Duffy are tight. Morelli and Duffy right now, I think you can say they are not. Some have accused Duffy of taking sides.
Either way, even Governor Cuomo is getting tired of the dispute. He told reporters this week that everyone better get over it or they'll jeopardize the project, which means thousands of jobs. Here's Evan pressing Bob Duffy on it.
governor's sending a message to the people he wants to send it to stop it. But I can tell you, it's not Bob Duffy. It's not Joel Seligman. It's not Michael Lear. It's nobody else involved with this project. We are working as a team and working well. We've gotten well beyond the headquarters back and forth. But I will just say one thing. This may be a manifestation of other issues here. What I found here in this region, we have turf issues. We have egos that abound in many different areas. I think Rochester has to align itself and far different. It's not about politics, not about egos. It's about doing what's best for this community. And I can tell you that if fights do erupt, if fights continue, we as a region lose. It's not about who wins and who loses. It's we would lose. Governor Cuomo and Howard Zemsky are both friends, both colleagues. I think they said all that needs to be said, and actions speak louder than words. And I think it just has to, and I'm telling you, I'm on phone calls almost every day with the photonics teams and on this issue. We're working and working very hard. And people from California, Arizona, Massachusetts, the Defense Department, and in Albany and here are looking for ways to find investments here in Rochester. So I think that's a sideshow issue. I would get the parties.
It's not slowing things down. Has the friction between Mr. Morelli and Dr. Calheiros?
I have not had a conversation with Joe in some time, and I've not talked to Dr. Calheiros in quite some time. So I've had no personal discussions with either one for quite a period of time, but I am on a phone every day. What we are doing is moving along without any hesitation, but I certainly would heed the Governor Cuomo's words and Howard Zemsky's words, because whether people agree or disagree with Dr. Calheiros, he has brought $40 billion to this state during his tenure here. His Rolodex is huge. And one thing I'm well aware of, he has been, for the last 4 years, he has been recruited from other states, Texas being one, who would probably quadruple his salary and accept his Rolodex. And we can either settle any differences and work as a team for the betterment of this region, or we can lose some assets here.
Let's turn to our conversation with the man who invented the word gridlock.
Sam Schwartz was working for New York City Mayor Ed Koch in 1980 when he coined that term. Since then, he's become recognized as probably the leading expert on traffic and transportation in the country. He's got a new book out, and he came to Rochester to explain how our city can embrace a move toward a multimodal future. That just means how to get over our addiction to the automobile.
This was a key moment. Sam explained how something dramatic and unexpected is happening when it comes to American driving habits.
Yeah, it's something that never happened, at least in my history of monitoring transportation, which is about a half century. But if you go back 120 years, we have always seen an increase in transportation usage, in car usage, which is measured by total number of vehicle miles traveled in the United States. It's gone up, 29 crash, goes down a little bit, then resumes going up. World War II went down a little bit, shot straight up, and then it continued shooting straight up till about 2003. And then something happened that no one predicted. No one can take credit for it. And it was nothing short of revolutionary. And that is for 10 straight years, driving in the United States, whether we're talking about New York City, we're talking about Chicago, we're talking about Omaha, we're talking about Los Angeles, for 10 straight years, driving went down. It preceded the Great Recession. It accelerated through the recession and continued after the recession. So when I looked at what happened, it was largely confined to one group. And it was such a dramatic change that you just don't see in social behavior without a war or something like that. And that is, younger people were driving not 1 or 2% less, which is the normal range of things, 20 to 25% fewer miles. It was extraordinary. And for 10 straight years, that continued to go down. And so I began to take a look at what's going on with the millennials.
And why here? And this is where some really fascinating twists and turns happen in this chapter, because the first thing you think is, well, okay, the millennials are driving less because the financial crash. But as Sam writes in the book, this started before the crash, and every financial crisis or world crisis over the last, essentially the last 100 years, we've seen a dip and then a resumption. Hasn't happened after coming out of the recession. And then you think, well, environmentalism, millennials are, you know, they're driving less because they know of the fossil fuel impact on the planet. But you look at surveys And that's not the answer either, is it?
No, no. And I find that there is no one answer. There are a couple of really good things. There's one good thing that government did, and that's about all the states in the 90s, just about all the states, introduced graduated driver's licensing, which made it a little
harder. This is like the last thing I would have thought would be the culprit, but this is one of the, you know, one of the easiest things to point to as a real possibility here. Tell us again what happened.
So state after state makes it harder for a 16-year-old to drive just with his or her friends, and makes it a little tougher when you're 17. And so you get a little bit older and fewer people getting driver's licenses because of that. And what we've learned is if people by 19 or 20 don't get a driver's license, the probability they will get one drops dramatically because they've learned to be an adult without a car.
Let's finish the week with our friend Jack Garner, longtime film critic and columnist for the Democrat and Chronicle.
Jack gave us his Oscar picks. He thinks Spotlight will win Best Picture and deserves to. And you can hear some of his other picks if you listen to the full hour podcast. But first, let's talk about something else with Jack.
We asked about the controversy surrounding the lack of diversity with the nominees. Here's Jack.
The industry deserves the criticism. I think it's broader than the Academy. The industry deserves it in the sense of how many opportunities do black actors and black filmmakers and black stories have to get told in the industry. And it's a real problem that they got to work on. The Academy, I know, did... You know, since the word boycott got mentioned, I think Will Smith and his wife and a couple other people are boycotting it. And so when that word started to get mentioned, the Academy had an emergency meeting like instantly, and they did a couple things which hopefully will help. One is that they are changing the way you're a member. It used to be you could be a member and you were a member for life. You could become a member because of your amount of work you do in the industry, or the even easier way to get it is to win an Oscar. You win an Oscar, you're in. What happens then is you're in for life. And there have been a lot of horror stories, not just about the black-white thing, but just generally about people who haven't made a movie in 20 years and they're in the motion picture home. And they may even be senile. And they get this ballot and they just hand it to their nurse. Fill it out for me.
That really happens?
That has happened. So what they, I mean, I've heard that. I mean, that's the story. Maybe it's sure. Apocryphal, but yeah, you hear that story. So anyway, it's in theory, it could happen for sure. So what they've done now is that they made it a 10-year, you're a member for 10 years, and then you have to continue to show that you're continuing to work in the business, then you get another 10 years, and then another 10 years if you prove that you're in it. If you've fallen away from the business, if you were a one-hit wonder years ago or whatever, what they then do is they make you a member emeritus, which means you don't have to pay any dues, and you get to all go to all the parties and screenings, but you can't vote. So that's one thing to try to get rid of people that aren't in with what's going on in the movie business. Secondly, they're adding three major seats to their governor's board, and they're going to make, you know, they're going to make a flat-out effort to make a minority, people of color or some other minority situation. So that's something, you know, and then the industry itself needs to be smart to it. But, you know, it was the same thing. It's been the same thing with women for years. Movies get made because the suits who okay them and pay for them are white guys, you know, and the day has to come when that's a little more broadly based. Some women have started to take charge of production and studios and also established their own companies. Some major actors or actresses, although they're all actors is the better word, I think, nowadays, they have taken charge and gotten enough power to make movies. And the same thing happens to happen in the African-American community.
That's Jack Garner. And that does it for this weekend's podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR FM 88.5, and WEOS 89.5 FM, Finger Lakes Public Radio.
I got the music on. We're squeezed in this tiny little studio we're recording now. Almost maybe sounds like a basement. Actually, I think it sounds good. We just, they can't see us. Why am I telling this story?
I don't know.
That's a great question. So enough of that story. Thanks for listening. You can also listen online every day, wxxi.org/listen, or the WXXI mobile app. And it's been great talking to you.